Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, we have some topics to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about pregnancy, the prevention of pregnancy, what happens with theoretical perfect use of anti-pregnancy things such as the birth control pills, and then what's the typical use and the failure rate. Very interesting information. And urinary tract infections and antibiotic resistance, the overuse of new antibiotics, what that means for us today and in the future.
Mm-hmm. And our recipe?
Parsley hummus. Hummus happens to be one of those appetizers I happen to love, and we've got a dynamite recipe here.
From a New York Times guest chef coming up.
Delicious.
Our medical myth buster, too, later on. But right now, let's get to the phone, Zorba, welcoming our first caller, a listener in Chicago, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Recently, I bought a pedometer called Fitbit, and my question is, if I wear this device on my bra, clipping it to my bra right over the sternum, does that have any negative impact on my health?
You mean because it's on your bra versus on your hip?
Correct. It is a great little device, and it just seems that because of its ability to go wireless, like to a scale or to my computer or my smartphone, I feel like it's emitting something, and I just don't know if that emission is dangerous in any way.
Just out of curiosity, why don't you want to put it on your hip?
Well, very frankly, I'm afraid that I will have it go through the wash. It's happened before.
not the same problem on your bra, right?
Obviously.
No, you can't miss it there.
You can't miss it on the bra, but you can miss it on the hip. I love it. It's going to go through the wash. That's exactly it. One of the things I would look at, the way the pedometer works is it works on whether or not you take a step. You know, before sort of the electronic ones, basically it was a little shuffle so that there would be a little spring in there, sort of like a pendulum, and it would go click, click, click. And they really were made for sitting on the hip. So the first thing I would do before we talk about the safety is I would see whether or not it measures things differently on your hip versus on your brassiere. In other words, I don't know how accurate it is on the brassiere. It's still going to give you an idea of what's going on. So you want to make sure that it's not emitting bad waves that may cause you something such as breast cancer, I assume, correct?
Yes, that sure have any effect on my heart. This Fitbit is different than a regular pedometer. It measures the flights of stairs that you climb. It measures how many miles you've walked, calculates how many calories you've used.
Wow.
And that's all on the little device.
Wow. Does it talk to you?
No, but when you pick it up first thing in the morning, it sends you a little message kind of prompting you to be active.
That's it. Tom, you could use this. You could put this on. It's prompting you to be active in the morning. I don't think it'll fit on your brassiere, but I think you
could
use it.
Well, I'm kind of active when I'm
No, he is actually. I don't think there's any problem. It's sending out a radio signal. That's generally what these are, which are really benign signals. I mean, that's what happens when you've got a wireless setup. No different than the wireless, we'll say, from your smartphone. You know, the issues with telephones and cell phones really had to do with brains and brain cancer and all those issues involved, but there was a very specific issue of the proximity of the phone to the brain. And when we look at it from a point of view, either on your hip or in your brassiere, it's not going to affect your heart at all. And it's the square of the distance that's mattered. It's not even linear. So in other words, there's going to be hardly any electrical energy. So how has this affected your health and your walking?
It was just amazing to me because I originally bought it as a pedometer. Mm-hmm. But on my smartphone, I can also put in all of the food that I eat during the day. And I'm not a big salt user. I don't add it to anything. But when I saw that I was getting 2 to 3 times the recommended amount of salt per day,
wow,
It really changed how I ate. I think that was the biggest thing.
And I think that's the biggest issue with all these things. How do they actually affect your behavior? It's great to log in the number of steps you're doing and the number of miles you're walking, but if it doesn't lead to healthier behavior, then why do it? So I congratulate you on using it and figuring out how to make sure it doesn't go through the washing machine and so you lose it. Thank you so much for
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I've been an off and on smoker for about 5 years, and I've been trying to quit for the past 3 years, and I'm actually only 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I recently came across a pin-shaped electronic cigarette
mm-hmm.
that is actually really helping me to switch
mm-hmm.
and leave the normal cigarettes behind. I'm wondering if you found any evidence to support that these are healthier, since, you know, smoke, tar, and additives are usually the parts of smoking that people say are the worst.
Yeah. Before Zorba answers, strokes to you at age 21 for wanting to get off of this stuff.
Right, right, right. Very, very good. You said you've stopped and started. How long have you stopped for at any time?
I've stopped probably like a month
uh-huh,
at a time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's not been exactly easy.
Yeah. No, no. So. I started smoking at about 17 or 18, and I quit at 21. And I remember it took me like 3 or 4 times to finally, you know, kick the habit. I want to hear more about that month time. When did you go back? If you stopped for about a month, what kicked you back into the habit?
You know, it's probably just kind of my surroundings. You know, you become familiar with, you know, a certain life that you have, and you pair it. You pair it with cigarettes.
Yeah, no, that's
everything
it.
You do mm-hmm. revolves around cigarettes.
Yeah, it's often, by the way, most people restart when they have a glass of beer or two. You know, glass of beer, glass of wine, had a couple of shots of Jack or something like that. And then alcohol drops their, you know, basic ability to make a good decision. That's why a lot of people drink alcohol and all of a sudden, you know, you take one puff and you're back to smoking again. First of all, let's talk about e-cigarettes.
Yeah.
E-cigarettes are very interesting. The feds tried to regulate them and they got knocked down in court in the first round. In other words, e-cigarettes won, FDA zero in that first round. Many of the e-cigarettes are laced with nicotine. So in other words, they too themselves are addictive. They're also laced with sweet chemicals that people tend to like. And I read a newspaper column and I wrote a couple of columns on e-cigarettes and got the whole slew of information from the e-cigarette lobby. How could you say these things are bad? They're really good for us. They've never really been tested, so we don't really know how they are. But you are inhaling a smoke. Often that smoke has some nicotine. It has other chemicals in it. You don't know what they're doing in the long run. So I have concerns, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you're inhaling stuff. And so I have concerns about it. If they help you quit the habit, you know, if you use these cigarettes for a month or two, in my mind, well, that's probably better than cigarettes. On the other hand, I really don't know. But they certainly are not benign in the long run. I think looking at what you need to quit your habit, you have two steps. A, quitting the habit. Using e-cigarettes, nicotine gum, the patch, bupropion under the name of Zyban, or Chantix, all these things will help. Hypnotism helps a lot of people. Getting it off, and then looking 1 month later, like you said, that's when you restart. What am I going to do from restarting again? So what are you going to do if you quit for a month to keep from going back to those cigarettes? That's the question. So that's my question to you. How are you going to do it?
I have no idea.
That's the tough part. That's the tough part. I have one suggestion, and here's my suggestion. Here it is. Maybe you're with some friends, you're with some buds, they're having a cigarette, and you say, gee, I want to have one. My suggestion is you leave and go to the washroom. I'm serious. You go to the washroom, you sit down on the john, and you decide whether or not you're going to have that cigarette or not. You remove yourself from that situation so you can use the rational part of your brain to say, do I really want that puff? Uh-huh. And if you really want the puff, you go back and smoke it. And 99% of the time, you won't. It's sort of a distinct thing you do with reflex because you're addicted. And frankly, it's an addictive habit. Yeah. So
let me try something.
Sure.
Why don't you tell us that you promise never to smoke again?
Okay. Well, I promise I'll never smoke again.
Can I again?
I promise to never smoke again.
Okay. And if you do, you're going to have to call and tell Zorba.
I love it.
Zorba,
the Tom Clark method of quitting smoking.
Okay, we're going to hold you to that now. All right?
All right.
All right. Good. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
I love it. It's a new method. We call it guilt by public
exactly.
radio. Guilt by the external source of public
guilt
radio.
Guilt always works
exactly.
for me.
Hey. Hey, guilt. Guilt sells.
Zorba, you say you have some info now on birth control and
yes,
various
yes,
birth
yeah,
control
yeah,
devices
yeah,
and what
yeah.
works and what
yeah,
doesn't.
Yeah, very, very, very interesting. So first of all, you know, when we get birth control devices, we have what we call perfect use. In other words, you take the birth control pill, use the IUD. What's perfect use and then what's typical use? So remember, birth control is generally used by younger people, right? They want to engage in birth control.
Sure.
And they're often used by younger people who are more fertile. So you've mm-hmm. got to look at perfect use and typical use. So if you look at the IUD, for instance, the IUD, perfect and typical use is about the same, you know, because the IUD is inserted in the
yeah.
uterus. You don't have to make any conscious decision. There's really no difference.
And what is the same? Well, how does it?
Well, in other words, in other words, there's a 0.2%
okay.
failure rate for the IUD that has progestin.
So it's very
which is
effective.
The typical IUD. Very effective, very, very minimal use. What do you think the failure rate is with oral contraceptives, the birth control pill, with perfect use? Okay, let's say perfect use.
I would say very, very effective.
Very effective, 0.3%. Comparable
yeah.
to the IUD.
Yeah.
How about typical use?
Well, you're saying women miss their pills
8%.
8%?
That is huge. That is high. Typical use. In other words, because a woman may say, you know, I missed a pill yesterday and they forgot that they missed a pill and then they took an extra pill
yeah.
and it's around mid-cycle and there's a failure rate with that. With typical use, I was really shocked with it. How about condoms? Perfect use for condoms happens to be 2%. Typical use is a whopping 15%.
15%. So guys don't know how to use it?
Well, they don't put it on the perfect way. They don't take them off the perfect way. There's spillage of sperm into the vagina. There are a whole bunch of things. In other words, you know, they'll say, well, I used a condom, but I still got pregnant. What's a 15% failure rate? 15% failure rate. If we look at periodic abstinence, which is the rhythm method, that's a 25% failure
yeah.
rate. Well, the
yeah.
condom use, typical use, is a 15% failure rate. That's huge.
Yeah, it is.
That's a huge difference. Withdrawal is up to 27%. We're going to put this information on our website. If you go to zorbapastor.org, we're going to put down a typical use and then what is perfect use for the failure rates of birth control options. And I think the reason why this is important is that when a woman chooses her birth control option, she wants to choose one that is perfect for her. And frankly, if you don't want to get pregnant, the best use appears to either be with an implant, hormonal implant, which is the progesterone implant that has a 0.05% mm-hmm. failure rate, very, very low, or the IUD. And the birth control pill is a whopping 8% failure rate. In other words, if you're going to take the pill, you've got to be perfect
yeah.
same
yeah.
time of the day, each and every day that
yeah.
you take it.
And people are different. Some women could do this and say, I know I'm going to do it right and do it right.
Right, absolutely.
And other women, maybe
yeah, that's
self-examination.
Exactly it.
And,
that's exactly yeah. a little self-examination. Examinational insight to
yeah.
say, what can I do? Sitting down with your doctor,
yep.
with your nurse practitioner or your PA and saying, now this is the adequate form for me. I mean, this is something doctors, nurse practitioners, and PAs don't discuss. We all assume that they have perfect use.
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
yeah.
No, not at all. It's the people with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, that have perfect use.
800-462-7413. You'll find a line open now. If you want to give a call, we hope we can help you out. 800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hello.
Hi.
What's up?
Oh, not much. I have a question. I've been trying to lose weight, and I've hit a plateau. But my other issue is that I have rheumatoid arthritis, and so I need suggestions about losing weight. That will make it easier on my joints.
Can you tell
besides
us what?
Besides swimming, because I don't really have very good access to swimming, even though I know that's the best thing.
What have you been doing?
Well, I've been using my elliptical, but sometimes that gets a little hard on my knees. I've cut my calories down to 1,100 a day and just trying to just always eat healthy types of food and not fatty foods, high-calorie foods,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You know, it's very, very hard. As you say, anyone with a chronic arthritic problem, it's really tough
right.
for them to lose weight because, first of all, they have to exercise, but then their joints hurt. And so when your
mm-hmm.
joints hurt, you don't want to exercise. When you don't want to exercise, you often sit around, and then you tend to eat more food, and it becomes very, very difficult. And dropping more calories than you have becomes really difficult because we have so many calories around.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How's your rheumatoid arthritis? How is it?
It's pretty good. I just get sore really easily, mm-hmm. so that's why working out has been difficult. Mm-hmm. Like, you can only do it for a certain period of time.
Uh-huh. And the elliptical has been helpful for you to use?
Yeah, I like the elliptical just because it's a more like fluid motion, mm-hmm. I'm not walking on uneven ground, so it's just like. Feels pretty steady.
Yeah, the elliptical can be quite good. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you on attacking this with rheumatoid arthritis. It's a difficult disease, and you should really be congratulated.
Is that 1,100 calories a day? Is that about right, Sorba?
Well, it's about right with what you can withstand. You know, if you go to a very low calorie diet of 700 or 800, people just don't stay on it. So, in other words, you might drop some weight when you have these really low calorie diets. But then, what happens is you put them back on because, you know, you just can't stand it. I think you're doing the right stuff. I think the elliptical is the way to go. Like you said, you don't have adequate access to a pool. And a pool, of course, is, you know, it's not that easy, especially if you're, you know, not in a sunny climate to have access to a pool that really is going to work for you. And one of the things that I would recommend is basically looking at how many calories you're actually expending, getting a pedometer, looking at how much you're walking, and then seeing whether or not you can get rid of another 100 or 200 calories, you know, to just drop below that 1,000 calories. That's very, very tough.
Some days I can. Some days.
Yeah. I wish I had a magic bullet for you. Yeah. Getting that RA under control, of course, is really there in having that. Another recommendation, if you go to a physical therapist recently or an occupational therapist, OT or PT.
I did have surgery last year on my wrist, and mm-hmm. I did see a therapist for that, and that was really awesome. It was very helpful, but that was just mainly for my hand.
But you may want to call your doc, and you may say, look, I need an exercise plan. I want to go and see a physical therapist. Most insurance is going to cover it because you're on RA. Talk to a physical therapist that's going to give you the right information for you. I think that's really the way to key that in.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you
so much for the call. At 1-800-462-7413. We have a guest chef recipe coming up. It sounds like a good one to me, parsley hummus.
Delicious.
More of your calls, of course, some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster. Plenty of good reasons for you to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But now it's, as you know, recipe time, Zorba. Today we have a special guest chef joining us. Would you please welcome Martha Shulman, author of the very popular New York Times column, Recipes for Health. Martha's specialty is creating dishes that help readers eat well without making them sacrifice flavor. And today we're featuring a unique recipe for something a little bit different, parsley hummus. So, welcome, Martha, and we'll get to that recipe in a moment. But first, what got you interested in healthy cooking?
You know, I've always been interested in great food, but food that also is good for you. I started out as a vegetarian cook many years ago before it was mainstream, and I've just always tried to put pleasure and health together.
I like that. Pleasure and health.
It's sort of what
maybe,
we try to do.
Maybe people will actually then follow it versus let's make it torture and health.
There's no reason. I don't see any reason to eat healthy food that doesn't taste good.
Yeah, what I tend to call the cardboard diet. You know, there's no reason to eat a cardboard. So you've been writing this column. How many years have you been doing
the column? I've been writing the column for about 5 years. I've written many, many cookbooks, so I've been doing that for
over the time. So when is it's in the New York Times. What day day of the week is this in?
It's actually online, mm-hmm. and it's every day on the health page.
So how much cooking do you do in the house? You've got to
a
write
lot.
The...
I'm testing five new recipes every week.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's just for the column. You know, I write cookbooks, too.
So how do you do that? How do you find time to do all this cooking? And
well, it's my career. It's what I do.
It's your career, yes, but who eats all the food,
then? You know, it's funny. I don't know. I throw out very little uh-huh. because I don't believe in waste. Mm-hmm. I have a teenage son who is really useful.
Is useful. You have to keep on having teenage sons to be able to eat the excess,
exactly.
to eat the excess food. And then, of course, you obviously have a party every night.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends
yeah, to come yeah. over and do other things. So let's talk a little about a hummus. It's sort of an ancient food that people have been eating for many, many years.
Yes, and I have to say that if you make hummus, then the hummus that you buy just doesn't taste that great because uh-huh. everything is fresh, whereas mm-hmm. if you buy it already prepared, the garlic just doesn't taste as fresh.
Yeah.
So I have a garden, and I have a lot of parsley in mm-hmm. my garden, mm-hmm. so I'm always thinking about what to do with that parsley. Uh-huh. And then it got me thinking, you know how you go to the store and you buy a big bunch of parsley because your recipe that you're
right.
working on calls for 2 tablespoons.
Right,
and
exactly.
then the rest of the bunch yeah. just yeah. sits in your refrigerator.
Yeah, what do you do with it until it turns yellow and then you throw
well,
it out?
Well, that's why I devoted recipes to parsley.
Oh, it's great.
uh-huh. And so this was one of them. And instead of just making plain hummus, mm-hmm. I take about a cup of the leaves from flat-leaf parsley.
I think it's a great idea. And that's what I do. I'll buy a bunch of parsley or sometimes 2 bunches, and it'll stay in the refrigerator until it yellows, and then I'll just take the parsley and throw it out. And I remember years ago I took a couple of cooking classes, and they talked about parsley as basically a wonderful herb that is – it's not exactly maligned, but it's ignored, you know, because
yeah,
it's not used
it's really,
in so many things.
It's a wonderful green, really. I mean, you can kind of see it as a salad green, or it's a great food.
Yeah, it adds quite a bit to it. Okay, so let's go through the recipe. And by the way, I've tried different types of hummus. I happen to like it. And there's such a difference, even brands. Some brands, as soon as I open it up, I'll say, why did I buy this? It doesn't
yeah.
taste very good at all. And then others taste a little bit better, so I'm looking forward to making this. Okay, we start out with 2 cups of chickpeas cooked. So do you start with dry chickpeas or do you buy canned chickpeas?
You can do either. Mm-hmm. I just usually have dried chickpeas mm-hmm. on hand. So I cook them, but if you don't want to do that...
You can use the can. Do you soak them before you cook them?
Yes. I mm-hmm. find with chickpeas, they really cook softer and more evenly.
And better.
Quicker uh-huh. if I soak them.
Use a pressure cooker or use
no,
a regular...
No, uh-huh. You can, but uh-huh. I don't.
Do you have a pressure cooker?
I have one. Uh-huh. It's on a shelf. I rarely take it down, but I certainly think they're useful.
Yeah, I had to buy one a couple of months ago, and I had to go to like 3 or 4 stores to find the pressure cooker. Every house used to.
Yeah, my mother used to use them every
yeah,
day.
Yeah, my mother used a pressure cooker yeah. all the time,
well, now
too.
Now they're a lot less scary than they were
no,
years
used to
ago.
No, oh, yeah,
they were scary.
Pressure
right.
cooker.
That top would blow off.
They
really
would,
improved them.
And people would die. You know, pressure cooker deaths.
Yeah, the ceiling.
Okay, so 2 cups of chickpeas that are cooked, 2 large garlic cloves peeled, cut in half, a half cup of parsley. So you like the flat leaf variety
yeah.
parsley, okay?
And with mm-hmm. the parsley, it's very important that you pick the leaves off the stems because mm-hmm. the stems are really hard mm-hmm. and they won't blend up.
So that's
the little tedious part of dealing with parsley. When you get that bunch home, take the rubber band off and mm-hmm. just put on some good music mm-hmm. or something you want to watch yeah. and just spend a little time picking the uh-huh. leaves off the stem. Uh-huh.
You know, I find with things that are tedium like this that if I actually put on a timer and look at how much time I'm spending, it's often like 3 to 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's not really that long.
It's not that long, but 3 to 5 minutes of tedium seems like 2 hours of tedium. Tom is looking at that. 1/4 cup of fresh lemon juice, very important that it's fresh, correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
very
important. Reconstituted lemon juice does not have the same taste at all.
Like
1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil, additional for drizzling. So, and 3 tablespoons of sesame tahini, well stirred. So, you have a certain brands that you like, or what do you?
I don't. I like mm-hmm. the runnier varieties. Mm-hmm. I like the Middle Eastern varieties. I get them at my local Iranian store.
So very important to do that. Okay, so step number one, optional if you want to, you write down, remove the papery outer shells of the cooked chickpeas. So those are in the cooked chickpeas from the dry,
yeah,
but not in the canned chickpeas.
This is what they do in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That's much more tedious.
Okay, so that's much. Okay, turn on the food processor with the steel blade, drop in the garlic, process until the garlic adheres to the sides of the bowl, turn off the machine, scrape down the sides of the bowl, add the chickpeas, parsley, salt to taste, and process to a coarse puree, stopping to scrape down the sides. So that takes about how much in the food processor? How much time does that usually take?
You know, a few minutes.
A couple minutes. So turn the machine on, add the lemon juice and olive oil. Very important to add that next while the machine is running. Then add the tahini. Process until the hummus is smooth. Shouldn't be too thick or too dry. You look at it. And then if you want to thin it out, you thin it out with plain yogurt or water. Which do you prefer?
You know, either is fine.
Or the broth from the chickpeas. Season to taste.
Yeah,
scrape out the bowl.
If I've cooked the chickpeas, the broth is the best.
The broth is the best because
it's got a lot of flavor
in there. And then run a fork over the surface, drizzle with olive oil, and serve with some crudettes or pita bread. That sounds wonderful.
It sounds delicious. Yeah.
Oh, it's really great. The color is really nice.
You know, I think pretty is also important when you're serving appetizers, if you're going to serve it with some vegetables. You like hummus, Tom, don't you?
Yeah, and I love parsley, but all you ever do is eat little thing of parsley
that
they put on the side there.
Yeah, I mean, once you get into a lot of Mediterranean cooking, you see that parsley is used in
lots of things. Very few calories. We've got roughly 50 calories in a serving. It's got a little bit of protein. It looks wonderful. This is a great, great recipe. So we're going to have a copy, of course, on our website, but you said your recipes are indexed on the New York Times website?
Yes. On the website, you go to the health page and scroll down. You'll see recipes for health.
And then your latest cookbook is
the very best recipes for health,
published by
Rodale.
Yeah. By Rodale.
Right.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much. This is a wonderful recipe. I'm sure lots and lots of our listeners are going to want to have a copy of this recipe.
Thanks,
Thank
Martha.
You.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank
bye-bye.
You so much.
To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Martha's latest book, The Very Best of Recipes for Health, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can search all of your favorite recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
one 800 462 7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Columbus, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you guys doing today?
We're okay. How can we help?
My visit to my pediatrician this spring brought about a exercise program in my family. Mm-hmm. And my pediatrician said that if we weren't heart pounding, sweating for 30 minutes, we were giving ourselves too much credit. And so we started running around the park behind my house. And I've got three boys that were doing this. And then at the end of the summer, I decided, well, let's change it up and let the boys each pick where they wanted to run to.
Mm-hmm.
And so my 5-year-old decided that he wanted to run out to Grandma's farm and back.
Okay, how
and
far?
And he would, well, and would not be dissuaded, and it ended up being just a tad over 3 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, he did it, he survived, he was a little sore the next day, but at that age, I've got a 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 5-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
At that age, how far is too far?
Before Zorba answers your question, Zorba, does that advice on exercise, you have to do it to a heart-pounding extent before it works, does that make any sense to you?
Well, there are a couple things about exercise. First of all, getting off our duff and not sitting in front of a computer, a smartphone, a television or anything else, any exercise is good. So, out of the box, I disagree. I think doing something with your body, moving, is always better than not moving at all. Now, you get more aerobic advantage if you get an exercise, where you're sweating. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
But for an 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, or a 5-year-old, 5-year-old.
5-year-old?
As long as you get them out of the house moving, they're going to actually do exercise, and that's really what counts, and probably it would stem childhood obesity. On the other hand, if you find something that works for you and your kids and you can do together as a family unit, more kudos to you. That is wonderful to do. And your question about your 5-year-old is a good question. How much exercise is too much exercise? I don't think anyone has ever really answered that question. Now, if your 5-year-old huffs and puffs and is exhausted and gets to grandmother's house and, you know, and collapses and you've got to rehydrate them and call the ambulance and put IV fluids, that's too much exercise for the 5-year-old. But I'm sure on your way there, you must have rested a bit, or did your 5-year-old just do 3 miles, in which case sign him up for the next marathon. He's Iron Boy instead of Iron Man.
We did stop at grandma's house for a drink of water at the well, take a little break there before we headed back into town.
I think that's actually great. No, kids and adults, you know, you base it on how well you do. You know, so like you said, he was a little sore the next day. That's one thing. If he goes, I can't move the next day, then that's clearly too much exercise for a 5-year-old body. But I think you're doing this with your children are much more likely to lead to a lifetime of exercise. And one of the things that's lacking in our schools, you know, as school budgets get cut, physical education and physical activities get cut too. And as a result, I think we have more childhood obesity than we ever had before. And I think doing the stuff that you're doing really makes a difference. So let the 5-year-old pick where you want to go. Follow the 5-year-old. And like any other thing, just make sure that they don't overdo it. And that means that the next day or that day you make a decision of whether or not it was too much for them to do. So congrats.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Isn't that interesting? Worrying about too much exercise.
Right? It's exactly the opposite. I mean, most parents are. I'm worried that my kid is sitting in front of the TV too much and watching TV. Here it is. I'm worried that my kid wants to run too far to go to grandma's house. It's exactly the opposite. I love it. I just love it.
1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Ann Zorba, a listener with us now in Beloit, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, the other day, we started out on a family trip that we do every single year where we go to this apple orchard I've been going to since I was a child. And my wife notices that I'm swerving around in the car a little bit and I can't quite keep her straight. And I'm not giving her very straight answers. And she asked me what my problem was, and I realized that I felt a little drunk. And then I tried to figure out why I felt that way. I remembered, well, I had some root beer. In the last couple months, certain types of soda, one being Barks root beer, make me drunk, for lack of a better word. I get a little incoherent, and it's equivalent to a few shots of tequila to me. And I'm kind of wondering why soda would make me that way.
Well, one of the things I would get checked out is to see whether or not you have diabetes. That would be an issue. There's no reason why a root beer is going to make you drunk. There is no alcohol in root beer. It's not going to make you drunk. It's not, you know, there's no alcohol in there, so you're not going to be drunk. But if you're acting in a strange way, then one of the things you want to see is whether or not your blood sugar is going super high because you're drinking a very high caloric drink, you know, made with high fructose corn syrup or made with sucrose. All of a sudden, your blood sugar levels are high. I would be tested for diabetes and see whether or not that's the factor. That's the one thing I would look at, because it doesn't make any sense for that. There are things called transient global amnesia, which sort of happen out of the blue, but they're really more like blackout spells, or they're more where you don't have any memory of what's actually going on. People find themselves at the side of the road. That doesn't sound like what you have. This has only happened in the last few months. Didn't happen a year ago or 2 years ago?
No, it didn't happen, and it only happens with certain types of soda. I can drink just about any type of clear soda. Mm-hmm. I can drink certain caffeinated beverages. Coffee doesn't do it. Basically, two to three brands of soda.
Yeah, that's there's nothing there scientifically that I could understand of why root beer is going to do it for you and Coca-Cola is not. But I would be checked for diabetes. That's what I would be checked for, because it's a high sugar load, and a high sugar load sometimes can affect you mentally and can make a difference. So that's what I would get checked out for. Do you love root beer? Is that why you're drinking it all the time?
No, I try and stay away from soda in general. I do. If I were to pick, it's either something clear or root beer is my preference for soda. My daughter really enjoys it, and so me and my daughter always split a drink. And that day, she wanted Barks root beer, and it completely skipped my mind that Clark's Root Beer has been doing that to me lately.
Yeah, you got to look at the sugar point of view. And once again with soda, we have to be careful, obviously, because it's a highly concentrated food source. And you look at a can of soda, a can of orange juice, you know, that you're talking about, you know, depending on the size, it might be 150 to 250 or 300 calories. So it's a high caloric drink, and that has to figure in on what you're taking for the day. So good luck. Get checked for diabetes, and thank you for your call.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before we take a short break, let's start the timer for another round of rapid fire. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
First up is John, who wants to know if there's a difference between high fructose corn syrup and fructose.
Well, high fructose corn syrup comes generally from corn. That's why that's what it is. And the corn lobby wants us to believe that all sugars are the same. There's a good question about that. I don't know. One may be truly more addictive than the other. The jury is out, but the calories are the same.
Next, we've got Dolores from Tennessee, who's itching to know how to solve her poison ivy woes.
Well, staying away from the field, making sure you wear gloves, and make sure that you strip at the washing machine so that you don't touch your clothing if you think it has poison ivy stuff on it.
It's rapid fire, so I don't have time to tell my childhood poison ivy story that I always tell. We move on to Trish, who's curious about your take on a recent fad of using olive oil and grapefruit juice as a gallbladder flush.
Well, I don't think anything flushes the gallbladder other than making sure we don't eat a lot of fats so we don't develop gallstones. Go thee on a low-fat diet, and thou shalt get rid of one's gallstones, or at least not have them bother you as much most of the time.
Up next is Dave, who wants to know what foods to avoid if suffering from an irritable bladder.
You avoid all foods that make your bladder irritable, Dave. That's what you do, but often cruciferous foods you're smiling at because that was a couched answer. Cruciferous foods such as broccoli and cauliflower and broccaflower can make the bladder worse, so you may want to stay away from those.
Let's go to Mo now, who'd like to know what type of rice cooker you use. Hers is getting yucky, and she needs an upgrade.
I buy a rice cooker from my local Asian grocery store, my favorite one, and I bought a recent rice cooker. It was a Japanese rice cooker. I think it was Hitachi. My last rice cooker lasted 22 years. I am scotch when it comes to buying rice cookers. I want them to last.
Almost done, Zorba. Carl from Troy, Alabama is hard-pressed to learn whether oranges lose vitamins when squeezed into orange juice.
They do not, as long as you drink the orange juice that you are squeezing right away. The longer they're exposed to the air, the more the vitamin C basically deteriorates.
Well, Zorba, you can relax because that's it for this week's edition of Rapid Fire, but make sure to get your question in for our next round of fun. Just send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
You'll want to stick around. We have some interesting research to talk about, more of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, some new research, Zorba, on antibiotic resistance for urinary tract infections.
Right. So, first of all, right off the bat, urinary tract infections are common. I mean, they're really, really common. In fact, the estimation is that 1% or 2% of all doctor's visits by women were from urinary tract infections. And when you've got one, you know, most of the time you're prescribing antibiotics. So you're talking about a really chronic problem. Well, the issue has to do with antibiotic resistance. Now, for many, many years, there are older antibiotics that are really quite effective. A drug called macrodantin, Macrobid, nitrofurantoin, a very common drug. It's been around for, oh gosh, I bet it's been around for 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. And sulfa drugs, which have also been around for 40 or 50 years, are really the mainstay of urinary infection drugs. But lately, quinolones, which are a relatively newer group, they've been around for maybe 20 years, have seen a resurgence. And as a result, we're also seeing antibiotic resistance to these newer drugs. And the feds are now worried that we're eventually going to develop, super bugs, if you will, that are we're not going to be able to treat.
Well, I know that's always a concern with antibiotics, but why would there be a concern about these newer ones when apparently there isn't a concern so much about the older ones?
Well, the fact is the older drugs will work 90% of the time. And so if the older drug does not work, the idea is let's start with the older drugs, either nitrofurantoin or the sulfa pill. And then if that doesn't work, then you move into a newer drug. That's a better way of doing it versus let's just go to the newer drug right away, which is promoting this resistance. We've seen quinolones, which are a great group of antibiotics, and we haven't had a new family of antibiotics in 25 years. Mm-hmm. Quinolones were introduced about 20, 25 years ago. We've seen the resistance of quinolones, for instance, in sexually transmitted diseases such as chlamydia, where quinolones were very good and they worked, mm-hmm. and we overused them. And as a result, we now have chlamydia, which is in gonorrhea, which is now resistant to quinolones. And this is the theory that these bugs are now developing resistance to these antibiotics.
Yeah, well, this is kind of interesting information, but information that most of us wouldn't care about because this is your job,
I think what's very important is when a man or woman goes in and if they get an antibiotic, they should say to their doctor or the PA or nurse practitioner who's ever treating them, is this one of the older drugs? That's what I want. I don't want one of the newer drugs. I think it's a matter of the consumer asking for it and the doctor thinking about it. I think it's really a two-edged sword because sometimes people will say, well, I want the newest thing.
Yeah.
That's really better, when in fact this is a good case where the older thing is really better. It's better to treat you and it's better in the long run because antibiotic resistance, if it develops in urinary tract infections, is bad for all of us.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have a splinter or a piece of grass or reed or twig under the skin on the top of my toe for like 2.5 months, and I'm wondering if it will dissolve
leave
it alone?
You know, they're interesting things. Most of the time they dissolve. Sometimes they take a long time to dissolve. Sometimes they may take months and months and months before they resolve. Is it festering? Is it red? Is it hot? Is it swollen? Is it tender?
No, that's why I'm not really haven't done much with it. Mm-hmm. It was from the beach at Sleeping Bear Dunes, and something just went in, and it never got red, never hurt.
Do you
hurt.
See it? How do you know it's there? You feel
it? You can see it. It's a little red spot, a couple, maybe three, tops of a pinhead, and mm-hmm. then you can see a little dark, but the skin is all healed over it.
Mm-hmm. So your body has walled it off. That's what it successfully has done. So what would I do? Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Is that what they say? It's not exactly
what I
say in
show.
Medicine. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, if this were in my toe, I wouldn't do anything about it.
There isn't any danger to having it?
Yeah, it doesn't. You know, people go, oh, my gosh, it's going to go through my blood vessels. It's going to go to my heart, and I'm going to die of a heart attack or a stroke.
I'd be worried about an infection.
Well, if there's an infection, then often you can get to it because you sort of open it up and you're able to take it off. It obviously is not an infection now, so it may work its way to the surface. You know, sometimes these things, people come into the office with these, and I'll use a splinter forceps, and I have to dig around, and sometimes I'm never really sure if I actually get it out, and other times you go right in and you pull it out and it comes out right away. I think in this case, I would leave it alone. I would leave it alone. Yes, that's
thank you.
I
that's what I wanted to hear.
Right. See?
I love your show. All right. Thanks, Norm. Appreciate
thank you
it.
Very
thanks
much.
Thanks for your call. I love it. I love it. No action is the key to listening to our show. That's exactly
well,
it.
Well, she appreciates you. Should give that advice all the time. Don't do anything.
Don't do anything. Don't do anything. That's right. Forget it. Don't do anything. That's what the show is going to be about.
800-462-7413. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. And Zorba, I don't scare easily, but this week's myth might be cause for alarm. Some docs are saying that being stressed out could actually shrink our brains. Do I need to start shopping for smaller hats?
Shrink our brain. Doesn't shrink your skull. You know, shrunken brain syndrome, you would think. That's right. That's right. It's the end of the earth. You know, our brains actually shrink a little bit as we get older. Now, that doesn't mean that we're losing our memory or losing our mind, and we make jokes about this all the time.
Yeah.
But you can't look at the volume of a brain and predict anything. I mean, you know, we looked for years at brain volumes on MRI scans, functional fMRIs and CAT scans, and we can't correlate it to memory loss or loss of executive function.
What about stress?
Well, there was a study out of Yale that showed that stress can make a difference, perhaps, in brain size. This is one study and one loss. I don't think the brain volume really has much to do with anything. And the reason that I say it is we know that brain volume changes as you get older. We also know that for many people, executive function, the ability to make a decision, actually improves. I mean, my ability to decide between doing two things was better in my 60s than it was in my 20s. In my 20s, I sort of didn't know if I should do X or Y. In my 60s, I go, oh, been there, done that. You know what I mean?
There's a store of knowledge there.
No, there's a store of knowledge. Even though my brain may be shrinkier, there's a store of knowledge there, but the volume doesn't mean much. I think we do know that depression probably changes synaptic function within the brain. When you're depressed, you don't think as well often, and that's there. But no, I think the myth that depression shrinks your brain is still a myth. I come down with gavel firmly on the side that it is a myth. That's my opinion.
I'm going to look up the word shrinkier.
The other definition. The other definition.
Have a big myth you'd like Zorba to shrink? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. And a Buffalo, New York listener with us now. Hi.
Hi. What's going on, guys?
Taking on your call is what's going on. How can we help?
Yep. So I called because I feel like I'm underweight, and no matter how much I eat or what I do, I can never really get past the threshold. I always feel like I'm kind of rail thin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 6'1", and I vary between like 165, 175, mm-hmm. and I decided a few months back, I'm like, you know, since it doesn't matter what I'm eating, I'm going to try and eat more fast food and junk food and see if it helps. So,
good idea.
So for the past between 4 and 6 months, I've eaten at least a double cheeseburger or a similar every day for lunch. And I still haven't gained any weight.
Yeah.
I go to the gym probably 2 or 3 times a week, but I just feel like I'm thin and I want to put on like another 15 to 20 pounds.
Okay, well, tell me again how tall you are and how much you weigh.
I'm like 6'1", and I weigh 173.
Okay, just to let you know, I am 6 foot tall,
mm-hmm.
and I weigh 148.
Mm-hmm.
And I am thin, but I don't lose any sleep over it.
No, but you did when you were younger, didn't you? Did you think about that when you were younger?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you
yeah
thought about
but it was mainly based on looks rather than...
Well, but on the other issue, you can't discount vanity. You can't discount how you want
to
feel.
Well, that's
or
why
how
he goes to the
look.
Gym 2 or 3 times
that's
a week.
That's right, that is true. Well, vanity and what's good health.
That's why I go to the gym.
That's why you go to the gym
total vanity. I don't care about my health at all. I want to go to the beach.
Exactly.
I love it. You're living in the wrong state to go to the beach. You can't do it as much. Well, you've just discovered that no matter how much you try to gain weight, you're still actually limited in the number of calories you'll actually consume over a 24-hour period. And you're one of the people, you know, and people joke about it. They go, well, you know, I'll give you some of my weight. But the reality is about 5% of the population wants to gain weight. Yeah. They're often guys, and it's often very difficult for them to do.
Yeah, and you can eat all the junk food, and it won't make any difference.
It obviously
I can
has
attest
not
to that. Yeah.
So are you like your mom or are you like your dad? Who in your family is thin?
I'm more like my mom.
Uh-huh.
I have 3 brothers and 3 sisters.
Yeah.
And even after 7 kids, she's still like stick thin.
So she's still sick. So this is where your genes are at. That's basically where it is. If you go to the gym, if you exercise on a regular basis, you feel like you're strong enough, you're doing the things you want to do, that's really what you have to pay attention to. You'd like to put on 15 or 20. Why do you want to put on the weight? Because you feel like you'll look better? Or what's your motivation
behind
it?
Well, I feel like, I don't know, I've just always felt like I'm like rail thin, mm-hmm. and I just don't really like the way that I look. Mm-hmm. Really, it's like the core of it, I think.
No, I think that's probably that's often the core of that thing. The fact is, you've eaten, you know, the wrong food, the double cheeseburgers, which are not the right food, but it's high caloric, and the result is you're fighting against Mother Nature. Some people find if they eat high protein soy protein shakes to add it at the end of the day, so it would be less likely to affect my appetite. In other words, I would have a soy protein shake. I'd probably try to add 300 or 400 calories before I went to sleep at night versus in the middle of the day. What do you do for a living?
I do sales for distribution.
Uh-huh. So you move around a lot. Do you have a pedometer? Have you ever worn a pedometer?
No, I haven't.
You might want to see how much exercise you're doing and try to sit in front of the television and do less exercise. Eat more junk food and take some ice cream out and just start eating chips. I mean, that might just do it. So
I do run, I would say. I probably run a couple times a week, too, maybe mm-hmm. 2-3 miles.
So 2-3 miles. So, I mean, all the stuff you're doing actually is keeping you healthy. And unfortunately, it's burning calories. So a lot of our listeners feel sorry for you on one hand and then wish that they had your problem at the other hand. But in all seriousness, yeah. It's going to be a tough thing. Adding calories at the end of the day might help. So good luck.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. Before we head out for the week, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for a quick question from Edwin, who's feeling a little left out. He writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I listen to your show regularly, and at the beginning of the program, you are always laughing. Would you mind sharing the joke? Laughter is good medicine and something we all need, so please share."
I actually laugh all the time, so it's my native personality. That's about as close as it is. I am a laughing
guy.
You're
happy to be starting the program, looking forward to it?
You know, don't worry, be happy. You know, the Bob Marley phrase definitely corresponds to me.
Do you need a dose of laughter or have some of your own to share? Just send your thoughts along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, we'll see you next week.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Todd Witter with help from Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1027Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.